In his new book, Capitalism Versus Democracy, law professor Timothy Kuhner looks to offer the keys to understanding why corporations are now citizens. Money is political speech. Limits on corporate spending are a form of censorship. Democracy is a free market, and political equality and democratic integrity are unconstitutional constraints on money and politics. Kuhner says Supreme Court opinions have dictated these conditions in the name of the Constitution, and he explores the reasons behind these opinions and that they form a blueprint for free market democracy and demonstrate that this design corrupts both politics and markets. Timothy Kuhner is associate professor at Georgia State University College of Law, where we welcome him this morning to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us, sir. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Joe.
Very nice to have you with us. I read two paragraphs summarizing a brilliant book that's, 300 pages. But even in that two paragraphs, you realize that there's a lot wrong. What surprises me is that in this discussion that you have of how quickly that happened. I mean, there were some fundamental problems all along, and yet we just made them worse.
That's fair. Absolutely. It happened very quickly, starting in 1976. And prior to 1976, a whole lot of important and meaningful things were happening leading up to the Voting Rights Act in 1965. And so the question in the 1970s was, having established universal suffrage, women could vote, African Americans could vote, there were no poll taxes, the states couldn't restrict suffrage. Having established universal suffrage, the question is, what would be the new means of political exclusion, and would it be monetary power? And starting in 1976, the Supreme Court held effectively that it would be monetary power, and that democracy had to be a market, and that attempts to make democracy accessible to ordinary Americans of average economic means were unconstitutional by their very nature.
Do you think that we will look at the Citizens United decision in decades to come as, I mean, we're already looking at it in a negative light. Many are, obviously. But do you think we will look at this still in decades to come as a turning point and a key decision that brought us down what you argued to be a very, very bad path?
We will look back on it in that very way. And I'm confident about that because of the ideology of the opinion, which is so shocking and so striking. The court says that prior case law concerned with the economic power of corporations co-opting democracy, that sort of case law interfered, quote, with the open marketplace of ideas protected by the First Amendment. The court said that if corporate speakers have influence over and access to elected officials, that doesn't mean that those officials are corrupt. The court said that favoritism and influence are not avoidable in representative politics, that it's in the nature of our representative system of governance that elected office holders favor the contributors who support policies that the office holders also support. The court really cemented their free market view of the First Amendment, and that's all ideological. The part that we will remember just as much besides that is how the opinion empowers a tiny, tiny fraction of the richest 1% of Americans and corporations to control outside political speech. A tiny, tiny fraction of millionaires and billionaires are dictating the terms of the political debate through super PAC and dark money spending.
Is there... When you just the title itself, Capitalism Versus Democracy, it obviously is a versus, but there's also a balance, and I'm curious as to have we ever, in your mind, looked at this in the right way and see a balance that works that we can go back to, or have we always in some way, shape, or form been that has been off kilter and needed to be corrected, and unfortunately through the court action, you argue, we have just made it worse.
Right. I would say the latter of those two options, in the sense that when the country was founded and the United States gained independence between 1776 and 1840 or so, it wasn't just only white males who could vote. It was only white males who owned property who could vote. And so our country was founded not just on slavery in the backs of millions of slaves who weren't citizens and who obviously couldn't vote. It was also founded on the privilege of white male landowners, and that privilege didn't get undone until Jacksonian democracy in the early 1800s. And you see the history of U.S. democracy is this history of gradual opening of our political system to, well, white men without property, African Americans, women, people who can't afford to pay poll taxes, and so on. And it comes right up into the 60s. And that's why I was saying that when the court steps in the money and politics cases in the 70s, they are faced with this decision about whether to favor this democratic evolution that had been going on for exactly 200 years, 1776 to 1976, or whether to put their foot down and say, this country is going to remain an elitist, unaccountable, economically based form of government. And that's what's so striking about the court's opinion starting in 76, is just that they interrupt this democratic evolution, which is our heritage and our promise as a nation. And you asked how we'll see Citizens United in the future. The economist Thomas Piketty gives us a good preview of that, because he and other economists are documenting the sharp, sharp rise in economic inequality since precisely the 1970s. And that sharp rise in economic inequality, which is global as far as capitalism is concerned, but it's especially pronounced in the United States, the dates of 1970 to 2010 overlap perfectly with the intervention of the Burger Court in the 70s up to Citizens United in 2010. You can't get such unequal economic gains without politics and democracy also being co-opted by capital.
So, again, the name of the book is Capitalism Versus Democracy, Money and Politics in the Free Market Constitution. Timothy Kuhner is our guest. The book is published by the Stanford University Press, Stanford Law Books. So, in correcting it, you seem to come down on to the point where we need that really nothing short of a constitutional amendment can get us back on track.
That is my feeling, ultimately, that given just how foundational and constitutional this problem is, it belongs within the category of problems that we've had to pass amendments to the Constitution in order to solve. And it is a very foundational sort of problem, and I'll give you an example of what I mean by that. Again, just thinking about our democratic trajectory, what was wrong with theocracy, right? Why do we have a separation of church and state in our Constitution? And of course, theocracy is wrong because it elevates religious hierarchy to a point of power over the political sphere. And so we have our First Amendment, non-establishment clause and free exercise clause in order to ensure that religion doesn't co-opt the state and the state doesn't co-opt religion, right? What was wrong with King George III and hereditary monarchy? Well, political power was vested in birth, in royal birth, and we thought that's a really poor criterion to premise political power on, and it's oppressive and tyrannical. What was wrong with communism? Well, the party dominated the state and the economy. What was wrong with dictatorship? Military rulers dominate the state and the political system and the economy. And plutocracy, the rule of the wealthy that the Supreme Court has enshrined in cases like Citizens United and McCutcheon established this past April. The problem with plutocracy is it's just another form of injustice that's just as foundational and just as constitutional as theocracy, communism, dictatorship, and aristocracy. And so you need to separate capitalism and democracy to a certain extent, at least to an extent at which both systems can be autonomous and they don't corrupt each other.
Which is always, I mean, that's always the danger. And again, this gets back to balance, because one can very easily hobble the other, correct?
Absolutely.
The other thing that I want to get to in the book, and we've got about 10 minutes left, but I want to get to, because we talk a lot about Citizens United, and you point out about other landmark Supreme Court cases that set this up. You touched on this earlier, and I'm hoping you can just dig a little bit deeper into that and tell us about how really this perfect storm of court decisions came and created what we are dealing with now.
Right. So back to the 1970s very quickly, that's the moment where, in a sense, there's this national conversation, right, as to whether, as Rawls says, the Constitution must take steps to enhance the value of equal rights for all members of society, and that people with similar talents and motivation should obtain positions of political authority regardless of their economic class, right? That's Rawls on the one hand, but writing in 1971, Milton Friedman, who gets the Nobel Prize in 1976, the year of Buckley, has a very different theory, which is more about price signals. It's about the market being superior to government. It's about the overall balance of spending and investing and dividends, bringing rationality and coordinating behavior and beating out anything that the state could ever do. You know, markets being wiser and better than government. And Friedman wins out in that decade over Rawls. And so the Supreme Court comes along in Buckley and says things that appear to be taken almost directly from Milton Friedman's writings. It says that the concept that government may restrict the speech of some elements of our society to enhance the relative voice of others is wholly foreign to the First Amendment, which was designed to secure the widest possible dissemination of information from diverse and antagonistic sources. The government can't intervene in this political market to enhance the power of ordinary Americans relative to the very wealthy. The court says the First Amendment denies government the power to determine that spending is wasteful, excessive, or unwise, and says that the Constitution ordains a free society, by which the court means a free market society. And those are the building blocks of Citizens United, because the problem with corporate political power is how unequal it is and how concentrated corporate wealth is. And so if, as Buckley establishes, you can't regulate corporate wealth in the interest of political equality, then how can you regulate corporate wealth? Why else would you do that? If you can't say that democracy ought to limit spending in order to bring a little bit more integrity into the political sphere, more diverse voices socioeconomically speaking, well, you've got Buckley to thank for that. That's 1976. Bilotti comes along. It's decided 2 years later by Justice Lewis Powell, who had written a now infamous memo to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce years before, talking about the importance of corporate political expenditures and the importance of an activist-minded Supreme Court. Now, this is Lewis Powell writing before Nixon nominates him for the Supreme Court. He's looking for an activist-minded Supreme Court to obtain social, economic, and political change. So a few years, about 7 years after writing this memo to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, Justice Powell is in a position to decide Bilotti, which is the first case about corporate expenditures from general treasury funds. And he says the inherent worth of speech in terms of its capacity for informing the public does not depend on the identity of its source. And so he says state legislatures and indeed at the federal level too, they can't discriminate against corporate political speakers. And so you get these sorts of baseline cases in the mid to late 70s, and there are others too. But one of the remarkable things about Citizens United is that it comes along after a change in the court's rulings under a more moderate Chief Justice Rehnquist. And Rehnquist's case law, cases like Austin and McConnell, talk about the importance of limiting corporate political power so that it doesn't take control over the economic, over the political sphere. So Citizens United definitely owes a debt to Buckley and Bilotti, but it has particular strength because it overrules the cases that were moving away from Buckley and Bilotti. So the Roberts Court said, we're not going to go in this more moderate direction that Chief Justice Rehnquist has laid out. We are going to double down on the free market theory of our Constitution.
Hillary Clinton has recently suggested that she's open to a constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United. How much do you think that is going to, that sentiment is going to gain traction, gain steam, and ultimately be a part of the discussion as we enter in a presidential campaign cycle?
Well, the bad news is we're not there yet, as the Senate showed last week,
right,
in failing to pass the amendment, the Udall amendment that had been introduced by Reid into the Senate. And there was a majority of votes, but nowhere near the two-thirds Senate majority that's needed, two-thirds of the House, and then three-quarters of the states in order to pass a constitutional amendment. So we don't have the support there yet in place. When big names like Hillary Clinton and even Barack Obama throw their support behind the amendment, that helps a lot. But ultimately, this is the early stages of what's going to be a very long fight that's worthwhile and necessary. And again, it's a fight that is going to be underscored and propelled to prominence by the massive problems we're having in the economic sphere as well. When you're looking at that rising political inequality, you're looking at crony capitalism, you're looking at corporations getting political favors and earmarks and tariffs and subsidies through their political spending, and then bringing those benefits back into the economic sphere to outdo their rivals. You're looking at the corruption of capitalism. And so gains are really going to the elite within capitalism instead of the general public. And as that trend continues to increase, as everyone's predicting that it will, there's going to be a moment of crisis economically and politically. And that's the sort of moment that produces the support and the mass mobilization that you need to amend a constitution.
With the president's support, what did you make of that in the sense of where he has stood throughout his 6 years as president on this issue and what he has done in his own campaigns?
Well, President Obama came out against super PACs. He criticized Citizens United very publicly and in a fairly confrontational way in his State of the Union address, actually just a couple weeks after the opinion came down in early 2010. And later, however, of course, he finds himself immersed in the political environment created by Citizens United, and his campaign eventually says, boy, you know, we won't unilaterally disarm, meaning that we oppose super PACs in principle, but with super PAC spending hundreds of millions of dollars against us, we can't afford to take the high road and not engage in the super PAC game. And so they go ahead and muster some very deep super PAC support, and there's a creation of democratically oriented super PACs. And this trend continues today with Lawrence Lessig's Mayday PAC, which is ironically a super PAC attempting to rid the world of super PACs.
That's a valid argument, right? I mean, you can't, if to get the power, to get that two-thirds and to get the vote, you have to be in office, and to do that, that's the game. So you sort of have to play the game so you can change the game. That's a valid point, correct?
Correct. The problem of money in politics is going to be worse and worse to the extent that certain Republicans are able to gain office. So when you have people who say, look, we oppose this, say President Obama and soon-to-be candidate Clinton, you'd rather have someone like that win if what you care about is reforming money in politics. You'd rather have someone who's aware of the problem but says, I can't afford not to play the game until we can change the rules, right? Because you can't win unless you play the game. So I do think it's a valid point. But eventually there's going to have to be a massive reckoning and confrontation over this issue so that we can say once and for all, we're going to stop playing the game here.
And I guess this leads me in our final moment to the optimism question. So sure. With all of this said, I don't mean this with any disrespect to you, but you you don't end reading your book with a happy feeling. it's not a oh goody kind of ending. So you know, do you think this is something, as we said at the beginning, that for decades to come we're going to have to contend with, or do you think, are you optimistic we will get our act together?
Well, I think getting our act together is a project of decades, but I don't think that's an unhappy thing. This capitalism v. democracy does end on a, wow, this problem is incredibly severe and incredibly well solidified within the Supreme Court, and it's worse than anyone thought it is in terms of the gravity of the problem. And so that is a tough place to end, but the goal of that, of this book, is to inform the general public and give them the tools they need and the information they need and the studies they need to really recognize the depths of where we've sunk in terms of our economic system and our political system. And so, no, it's not tremendously happy in terms of the discoveries that it makes, but information that owns up to reality, right, and that recognizes where we really are, that's good information, and every problem starts, the solution to every problem starts with recognizing honestly where the station at which you've arrived. And I don't think that that has to be a tremendously unhappy thing, because lots of moments in U.S. history are tremendously exciting because they involve these confrontations. Once people have woken up and said, wow, you know, the depths of this political exclusion are so severe that it's worth it to me, and it's a good statement of my life and my orientation to my political system to get involved. And so I think that kind of waking up, right, that kind of awakening and that kind of political energy is an invigorating thing and an optimistic thing. And when people come together and they give it all that they have on the basis of good information, whether they win or lose in the end, at least they've lived a life of dignity as citizens.
The name of the book is Capitalism Versus Democracy. Timothy Kuhner, thank you very much for being with us and sharing your expertise with us. I greatly appreciate it.
I appreciate it, Joe. Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much. The book published by Stanford University Press, Capitalism Versus Democracy. You're listening to The Roundtable.